When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
All right, we are back at the Cracks of Postmodernity. Today we have Ray Suarez, author of the book We Are Home, which just came out last week. He's also the host of the radio program and podcast on Shifting Ground. Ray, thank you for coming on.
Great to be with you, Stephen.
So Ray, for those who aren't familiar with you already, tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to write about and speak about the topics that you cover.
Well, I've been a reporter for my whole adult life. My last non-repertorial job was baking bagels in Rego Park, Queens.
Wow.
But since then, I've worked in news organizations, large and small, in varying capacities, including NPR, PBS, NBC, CBS, and many others. My career took me to Al Jazeera America, which was exciting because it was a well-funded startup, and eventually deflating because it was a hopelessly, oddly run well-funded startup, which sank into an ocean of red ink and started a new phase of my career. So I've really been an independent journalist in the years since Al Jazeera America went out of business and, you know, able to do a lot of projects that probably would not have come my way otherwise. So while the freelance life has its difficulties and its challenges, it's also, at this age, I'm well into my 60s now, brought some interesting assignments as well.
Yeah. And so now, you know, we have the book We Are Home that just came out this week. We're going to be publishing an excerpt of it on our Substack. Tell us a little bit, I mean, give people a gist of what this book is about and what inspired you to write this at this point in your career.
It's called, the full title is We Are Home, Becoming American in the 21st Century. And it's about the modern era of immigration to the United States. In the 1960 census, America hit a modern low in the percentage of people living in the country who were born elsewhere on the planet, 5%, which we hadn't seen a percentage that low since probably the 1850 census. And it was a sign that the traditional sending countries of American immigrants in Western Europe were no longer places people wanted to leave in quite the same way. Immigrants were older than the median age. Immigrants hadn't come in large numbers since before the 1924 Immigration and Nationality Act. And in 1960s America, immigrants were, you know, your grandpa, your nona, people from the old country, people with accents, people who had odd customs that you cherished inside the family. They weren't a huge new population working at jobs all up and down the economy. Then in 1965, the United States made a big decision to change the formulas for how people could come in and where they could come in from. And that's really created the America of today with all its excitements and its discontents. And I really despaired when I looked at the discourse around immigration. I found it too ahistorical, too hostile, too much lacking in information. And I wanted to slot in this book to widen the conversation, let's say.
Yeah. So I want to jump into this, the current discourse on immigration, which clearly is, you know, hot button issue, very divisive. In your research, what do you think is most lacking or what's forgotten most in our current conversations about immigration?
Well, right now we're demonizing immigrants. Not we. We is such a big, broad term. Many people are demonizing immigrants. Our leaders know that immigrants commit crimes at lower rates than native-born people. Our leaders know that immigrants are probably the best educated they've ever been in the long history of immigration to the United States. Our leaders know that they have tremendously high rates of workforce participation, that they have fertility rates that are above the levels of native-born women. So will help us with some of our demographic problems down the road when we're going to have a huge generation of older Americans. I'm one. I'm a peak boomer. And they know all these things, yet they're willing to demagogue the issue in ways that are really discouraging. Yes, we have a crisis. Yes, we have a problem that needs to be addressed. But look, the world has that crisis. And the idea that America was somehow going to escape the gravity of this situation worldwide with millions of people on the move was naive, was silly, especially when we are the richest and most powerful country on the planet, as we've been for a long time. 25% of the population of Venezuela has left the country. The idea that we weren't going to get any of these people, ridiculous. More than 15% of the entire population of the island of Cuba has left the country. The idea that a lot of those Cuban immigrants weren't going to try to get into the United States, crazy, naive, irrational. But instead of discussing this in a broader global way and talking about the United States stepping up in the way other countries in the world have been challenged, we act as if we can somehow escape this moment in history. And I wanted to remind people who these immigrants are, where they're from, and the law, the change in American law and the change in American life that's welcomed them here in the last 60 years.
You know, so, I mean, with the, to be frank, most of, I mean, my sympathies are aligned very much with yours when it comes to this question, but I do want to play devil's advocate just for the sake of, you know, engaging the discussion more. I see a lot, I mean, there are plenty of people who have a very, just a straight up xenophobic kind of attitude towards immigrants. And you see that that fuels a lot of the opposition to more people coming into the country. But then you do see people saying, you know, on one hand, you know, a lot of the immigrants who come here are not afforded adequate legal and economic protections. A lot of them don't get work that pays very well. And again, if they get sick, if they're injured on the job, you know, they're not really taken care of. Others say, well, what about, you know, the countries that they're coming from? Like, rather than, you know, is the solution really to tell them to come to the US, to other countries, rather than to try to alleviate their suffering there? I mean, like, what do you make of these types of arguments, these objections to?
Well, they're realistic. And Stephen, they are rational responses to the situation that we're in. But let's think for a moment what the reaction among the very same people who are slamming the Biden administration for the fact that people are voluntarily trying to sneak into the United States from other places, the same people who are slamming them would also slam them if they tried, for instance, to make a big play for improving the conditions in countries that are hostile to the American way of life and to the United States as a country. If the Biden administration made an overture to Cuba and said, look, let's help you figure out your problems. It's not at all clear that the Cubans would be open to that or amenable to that, but let's say they did. Let's say Kamala Harris flew to Havana and said, look, we recognize that it's a major social dislocation to have a tremendous part of your workforce just leave the country. We want to help you. Oh, the same people who are complaining about people showing up in Nogales and Ciudad Juarez and Tijuana would be complaining all day long that the United States is helping Cuba, that the United States is helping Venezuela, that the United States is helping Honduras and El Salvador. So the disingenuousness around this issue is really galling. This is a time when it's other people's problems that are visiting themselves on us. The Germans didn't tell a million Syrians to flee their country during the worst of the Syrian civil war, when the al-Assad government was bombing civilian neighborhoods in so-called rebel cities and reducing them to rubble. Those people ran out of that country. They got on boats. They walked. They flew to third-party countries and then tried to walk into Germany. Germany had to respond. It couldn't say, well, let's just see what happens. There had to be a real-life response. And there was. And it was difficult. But it showed a country that was at least mature enough to grasp the nettle. What we're doing is throwing broadly different problems into the same pot, calling them the same thing, and saying a solution to this whole thing is so big, we can't possibly do it. And that's the thing that's driving me absolutely nuts. The problem of 13 million or so people who are long-term resident in the United States, contrary to our laws, illegally resident people, that's one problem. The people standing in Mexico trying to walk across the border into the United States are a totally different problem. And it is irrational to talk about them as if they're the same thing. The average illegal resident of the United States has been here for more than 10 years. They have kids, they have homes, they have businesses, they're members of churches, they live in apartments, they are part of the communities that they live in. They are something quite different from a young fella who's presenting himself to a border agent in Southern California and saying, if I go home, they're going to kill me. I want to stay in the United States. They are two different problems. They need two different sets of solutions. But people have said, oh, we have to do comprehensive reform. We have to do everything at once, so we can't do anything. It's a dodge because they want to use the issue politically.
Yeah, I mean, this oversimplification of all the nuances, all the differences, we see how, I mean, it's easier, you know, it's much easier to simplify. But, you know, I think what you're highlighting is there are very real consequences. There are people who, I don't know, but there's a cost to this kind of drastic simplification.
Well, you know, I'll give you a perfect example with Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
The United States opened diplomatic relations with Cuba after a long freeze that lasted all the way back into the early 1960s. The Obama administration put an ambassador in Havana. Havana put an ambassador in Washington. And the United States got rid of the very controversial wet foot, dry foot policy that said that if you managed somehow to get onto American soil, you were in. That Cubans were given a fast track to legal status in the United States that was different from people from every other country on the planet. Okay, we got rid of that policy and assumed that the number of Cubans coming would dwindle. Instead, it burgeoned. Why? Because we don't control day-to-day life in Cuba. And Cuba is a very difficult place to live right now. So what they're doing, people are scaring up enough money because they have visa-free entry into Nicaragua, a fraternal Latin socialist state. They take the very short flight, pull out a map and look at the map, take a very short visa-free flight one way to Nicaragua and start making their way north to the U.S. border. And today, more Cubans are showing up than during the height of the Mariel boat lift, during the Balsero crisis in the early 1990s. It's amazing. But there it is. Can we just wag our finger at Cuba? Normally a hostile nation with which we have difficult relations, and say, stop letting those people come. They don't want those people to leave the island either. Yet here they are. We've got a problem. We've got to deal with it. And our politics, the gears of our politics have seized up and are totally ineffective.
And one of the topics that you get into in the book is the, you know, the tension between, you know, an immigrant community and the host culture of whatever nation they're coming to. Especially in the U.S., you see, you know, different trends of assimilation and how they play out. They play out differently according to each, you know, the respective cultures of each immigrant group. I'm curious, like, with your knowledge of the history of immigrant communities in the U.S., like, what do you see happening now? Like, how is this kind of process of assimilation playing out differently, perhaps, than it did in the past?
It's a replay of things that we saw in the second half of the 19th century and the earliest years of the 20th century until the laws were changed, making it harder to come in. Immigrant communities, depending on their size and depending on their geographical concentration, can either preserve a high degree of ethnic solidarity, or they can't because they are a small ingredient in a very large ocean. So you go to a place like Queens, the borough of New York City, and it is quite amazing to see neighborhoods like Elmhurst and Flushing and Jackson Heights, which are some of the most dazzlingly diverse and highest concentration of Asian-born people in the United States. There is distinctiveness. So Nepalis and Bangladeshis and Thais stay those things, but also a high degree of acculturation and a high degree of assimilation, similar to what we saw over 100 years ago, where parents despair about their children's ability to speak the language of the ancestral homeland, where grandparents try to speak to their kids in Korean or Bengali and find that they're having a one-way conversation, or that the kids answer in English, even though they fully understand the language that's being spoken to them. This is not new. We've been here before. You could have gone to a newsstand in 1920 and seen two dozen ethnic newspapers in Norwegian, in Yiddish, in Italian. Now those same newspapers, to the extent that they still exist, are largely in English with a couple of articles in the old language. One good model would be the Jewish Daily Forward, one of the United States' historic Yiddish language newspapers, which still has a couple of articles in Yiddish, but is mostly in English today. What's taken their place? Chinese newspapers, Russian language newspapers, taking advantage of the post Cold War migration to the United States of Russian speakers from all over the old Soviet Union. And, you know, it's just a natural progression. It happens fast or slow, but it always happens. There is less language dominance and less language facility in the first generation born on American soil, and still less in the next generation. And that across immigrant groups, that turns out to be the case.
And I mean, one of the things I'm observing, especially now with the predominance of like discourse that celebrates diversity, inclusion, and all that, I'm seeing a lot of young people who are somewhat assimilated in a way, kind of trying to reverse this process. Like, for example, I see a lot of, you know, young people, teens, people in their 20s, who are children, either, you know, first or second generation of Latino immigrants, who don't speak Spanish fluently, forgot whatever Spanish they knew, but are actively trying to retrieve their roots because they see like being totally assimilated is kind of boring. You know, I mean, on one hand, I see that, but I also, like, I think about when I was in high school in a very, very assimilated suburb in New Jersey. And we had a couple of Arab students who were Muslim, but were very, very quiet about it. Like, there's only one girl who wear a hijab. But I'm seeing now that, like, in the popular culture, there's more visibility of Muslims and also, of Arabs in general. I'm seeing people now that there's like, there's a language, there are commonly understood, like, I'm trying to think of the word, you know, but there's more visibility. The point is,
right. And you're observing a phenomenon that is very much present, and very much allows immigrant communities to keep a measure of that old country culture. A lot of it is digital distribution. Pakistanis couldn't have their own TV station, but they could very well have a digitally distributed online radio station, and they do. You can listen to programs in Urdu. You can listen to programs in Arabic. And because the cost of distribution and the ability to reach the interested parties is so changed by the digital world, it makes the maintenance of that culture a little easier. One of the most interesting stories I did in the years after the 9/11 terrorist attacks was to visit the oldest mosque in America. And, you know, if you just ask the average person, where's the oldest mosque in America, they might guess, you know, New York or Detroit or Chicago, and those would be pretty logical, pretty good guests. But it's in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Wow. And the Mother Mosque was founded by the descendants of peddlers from the Ottoman Empire who came in the last years of the 19th century and the first years of the 20th. They were single men. They had a horse and cart, and they sold needle and thread and bolts of cloth and pots and pans and stuff like that from town to town, because they didn't have the kind of capital that it would take to have a fixed location store. And these traveling peddlers weren't going back to the Ottoman Empire, which was on its way toward disintegrating. And they stayed in the United States and married local women. And they started this mosque. And there it is. There's a little graveyard just outside town with these family names. Turkish and Arabic family names. And they maintained who they were through physical proximity. So the ability to create a small community in a much wider Christian milieu kind of forced them to stay proximate to each other. What's different now is the scale.
Yeah.
So that Islam, because of various migratory flows in the last 50 years, can create a beachhead in some of the most unlikely places. In the book, I write about Murfreesboro, Tennessee, and a mosque that outgrew its original home and ran into problems when it tried to move from a storefront to a purpose-built building on the outskirts of town in the years after the 9/11 attacks. And the both terrible and inspiring message of finding out that some of your neighbors fear you and are suspicious of you, while some of your neighbors who are not Muslims will come to your aid at a time of crisis. It's a great story, and I hope people read it.
Yeah. No, and on the other hand, though, so like as we're saying that certain immigrant groups are gaining more visibility in the culture, I also see how the reverse has happened. So like I think of my parents, my mom is Greek and my father's Italian. When they were in high school, like that was a thing. Like they were the Italian kids, they were the Greek kids. They had a culture that, you know, people recognize as something unique in itself. In my high school, like there were Greek kids, there were Italian kids, but we were completely assimilated. Like there were no like commonly recognizable markers that distinguished us. And like we knew which people were Italian or whatever, but like it didn't really mean anything anymore. And like I have to say for myself personally, like I felt that that was like that was something was lost, you know, because
but that, Stephen, that's don't mourn that. That's just the American way of ethnicity.
That's just how it is.
You know, the largest single European descended group in the United States for two centuries was Germans. And for a long time, there was a native-born, continually replenished, ongoing German culture in the United States. But events overtook that, both the age of the migratory community itself. So the people actually born in Germany aged out and died. Their descendants faced the headwinds of American hostility toward Germany after the First and Second World Wars. But over time in the United States, they learned English. So you'll see a brick building in town which says in German, Evangelical Lutheran Church, across the doorway. But they haven't had services in German in 85 years since the last people who really wanted to go to Sunday services in German died. And the last ordained people who could actually perform a service in German retired and disappeared. It's just the way we do this. Yet there is a town in Michigan, Frankenmuth, which is sort of this little Shangri-La, this little brigadoon of German culture. And you go to it and there's oompa bands and people in lederhosen and cuckoo clocks and beer and all that jazz. We preserve consumable ethnicity in a way that we both sell to ourselves and to others. And, you know, don't be ashamed of that game. It's just the way it is. It is a measure of acceptance at the same time, because part of what kept those ethnicities alive and vital was the feeling that other people don't understand us. And we have to talk to each other and nurture this ourselves, because we live in this hostile culture that doesn't care who we are and what we do. Italians in New Jersey are just part of the oxygen of New Jersey. They are very, very well established there. Governors and U.S. senators and the archbishop and on and on and on. You know, do they consider themselves a marginalized and despised ethnic group? Well, maybe they did 100 years ago, but not now.
Yeah, but the loss of the cultural markers, I don't know. I mean, I get what you're saying, like this is inevitable. This is the way of the game, but I do think it's sad in a way, because there's something about maintaining these traditions, these rituals that does give life a certain depth that makes it a little more exciting. You know?
It was a house thing, though.
Yeah.
Once people moved out of urban ethnic ghettos, highly concentrated settlements of co-national migrants, into suburbs, which were not coded in the same way, a lot of the civic pillars that kept Italian-ness or Greek-ness alive had to renegotiate a new landscape, where a church with a lot of Italian, a Roman Catholic church built in the suburbs with a lot of Italian members who have moved out of Paterson and Newark and Brooklyn and the Bronx, also has a lot of people who are Irish or Polish. And is not marked. I mean, maybe the saint's name, the saint they honor as their patron, might be an Italian saint, but that's as far as it goes. They might have a festa around the saint's day, but little to mark the place as peculiarly and particularly Italian. And often those suburban people will get in the car and drive back to the old neighborhood, Arthur Avenue in the Bronx or 18th Avenue in Brooklyn, to go to ethnic celebrations back in those places, because that's what's familiar. And the geography of the suburbs doesn't really lend itself to that kind of thing, carrying the image of a saint around the streets. Where would you carry one in a lot of suburbs with no streets that meet at right ankles?
Oh, it would probably fall
semicircular drives.
No, but look at the
Gili being carried in northern Brooklyn, where men still vie for the honor of carrying that tower through the streets of a neighborhood that probably hasn't been majority Italian in, 40 years.
Yeah, I mean, but that is my experience growing up, though, because in the suburbs, yes, okay, everything's kind of, monolithic. And then we would go to Newark for the Feast of St. Gerard every year. And everybody's, everything's super Italian and everything's, but again, everything's vibrant. Things are much more lively than they are in the suburbs.
But that might be a suburbs versus city question rather than an assimilated Italian versus non-assimilated Italian question.
Yeah.
But it is good for this old guy to hear a young guy rhapsodizing about that, because, when I would talk to foreign-born people as a kid, they leaned very heavily in the 1960s into putting away those things, being understood to be American, not being apparently from somewhere else, wanting to be accepted as non-hyphenated and so on. Yeah. And there's an old saying among sociologists and among people who study this area, the grandson tries to remember what the son tried to forget. Exactly. And I see that going on right now.
Yeah, no, and the other thing, I mean, I do want to jump into the old neighborhoods topic a little bit more, but I do want to say, just kind of tying together what you're saying about more recent immigrant groups versus the older ones, what I'm seeing, especially in Jersey, also in some of the boroughs in New York, a lot of these old Italian parishes, as the Italians go to the suburbs, also become a little more secularized. You see a lot of Latinos moving into these parishes, and they bring their own saint celebrations, their own, holidays. And I have to say, for me, I find that having this common point of reference of religion, of faith, enables me to enter into the celebrations of another culture, even though, again, celebrating Guadalupe in December, that's not coming from my culture, but I appreciate it because, I share these common spiritual beliefs with the people, the new immigrant group in the parish. And there's this possibility of exchanges that kind of religious spiritual setting allows for, which, I'm finding it to be, it's a very interesting cultural exchange, between the old.
Sure, and ethnic succession, in many cases, the church became the stage on which this social drama was played out, because newly arriving groups often lived entirely parallel lives to already established ones, but the church, because of the way the church is structured, offered this mixing bowl that the workplace didn't, social and fraternal and other kinds of organizations didn't, but the church, there it was. I mean, if the Knights of Columbus wasn't going to accept the new people, we were going to have a problem.
So now I do want to talk a little bit more about old neighborhoods, because I mean, you wrote the book, The Old Neighborhood, in, was it 99?
1999, yeah. Okay. 25 years old. It needs a rewrite and an update, but it's still a pretty solid piece of work.
Well, but that's what I want to ask, though. I mean, in these 25 years, what do you think has changed? Or what would you add if you did a rewrite or an addendum to the book?
What was talked about and perceived as the urban renaissance was still in mid-course in the late 90s. And I think economic progress and the intensification of gentrification and the intensification of a return to the cities and a re-falling in love with urban life was still to come at the time that I finished the book. So I was right about a lot of things. I looked at places like Philadelphia and Cleveland and wondered if, even if you do a lot of the right things, is reviving some places just such a heavy lift that it's going to be hard to pull off? And I think, having lived in Philadelphia and having returned to Cleveland in the years since, I think I was pretty right. I might have gotten Cleveland righter than Philadelphia, because Philadelphia has a geographical advantage in being between New York and Washington, D.C. But I think now the pandemic moderated, the pandemic midwifed falling out of love with the cities, and the George Floyd summer midwifed falling out of love with the cities is something that I couldn't obviously have anticipated, that the fair-haired children of American reurbanization, places like Seattle and Portland, would be so demonized in the political, cultural, public mind. Places like the Twin Cities would become such targets for people who remain implacably hostile towards cities. And also the amount of immigration over the last 25 years and the way economically successful cities have acted as immigrant magnets have changed the story in a way that I might have anticipated, but also couldn't have imagined the degree of immigrant arrival. You know, journalists don't predict the future. And in some ways, I got some things right and some things I missed just because they had yet to happen. And it was hard to see in the late 90s exactly how that was all going to go. Crime kept dropping. I was talking about drops in violent crime, how American cities were typed as dangerous, how they read culturally as places of disorder and chaos and danger, even though they weren't. And I complained about that, and I still complain about it. Crime kept going down in all of those big metropolitan areas until it stopped during the tail end of the Trump years. You know, people complain, for instance, about Bill de Blasio. A guy I have no particular fandom or love for. But when you ask them the trivia question, when were the lowest recorded rates of murder and violent crime in New York history? They rarely will say, oh, yeah, during the second de Blasio administration. But that's when it was. The pandemic really slammed on the brakes. The pandemic and the George Floyd summer slammed on the brakes for what had been a renaissance in the safety of American cities. So, you know, the final verdicts, as always, in American urbanism are still to be written. I think some things have unfortunately continued to develop, like power centers and strip malls and strodes and faux urbanism, where you build this precious little main street and then surround it with acres and acres of parking so people who live in suburbs can drive to it and pretend they're in a city for a couple of hours as they do their recreation, go to the movies and go to a restaurant. Those things have continued apace, along with wonderful things that continued to happen in the 25 years since in American cities. So still an open verdict.
Yeah, and I mean, much of my interest in this question is, again, like based on my experience growing up in the suburbs, because over time, especially, you know, after I did move into more urban settings, especially, you know, I spent a couple of years in one of Newark's old neighborhoods. I saw how much there's this difference on many levels, on a psychological level, social, on a spiritual level, like life is very different. And I think the nature of suburbia, as you're saying, the fact that it's so spread out, that there's so little opportunity for spontaneous interaction, like that does take a toll on you. Like there's something I think there's something about that urban life, the old neighborhood, that's really preserves something human, you know, that I think gets lost in the suburbs. And
when people
I
have discretionary dollars to spend, mm-hmm. and time, yeah. Where do they go? They go to Faneuil Hall, and they go to Georgetown in Washington, and they go to Old Town Alexandria in Virginia, and they go downtown to Grant Park and to the Bean and Millennium Park in Chicago. And they go to the historic 17th century urban core of Philadelphia. That's voluntary. They're not told to go there. They're not ordered to go there. They've got money in their pocket. They've got time. Maybe they have a couple of kids in the back seat. They go to places where you see other people, where you have a variety of options for things to do, to relax, for recreation, to be seen by others, to see somebody playing music on the street and just stop casually and listen to it. If you played on a semicircular drive somewhere in suburbia, you'd play for yourself for hours. Somebody might accidentally come by or roll down their window when they came by in a car. But the architecture of those places, as you well understand, is built purposely to keep people from pooling up. There's no place to walk to. And if you did all plan to walk to someplace, there'd be nothing to do once you got there in all too many places. So when people have it on their own, they do this unplanned and voluntarily. And look at Disney. Disney, one of the great understanding companies of American suburbanization. What do? They build faux town centers like downtown Disney in Orlando because they understand this impulse that people want to be seen, they want to be together, they want to be unplanned and spontaneous, and this is how they want to spend their discretionary dollars. When people vote, nobody goes to a place built on the development perimeter which has nothing but residential space. They don't go there, and they don't stay there, and there's nothing to spend money on, and there's nothing to do there. That's why they don't go there. Watch people, watch what they do when it's all their choice, and make your conclusions.
But I mean, so obviously, again, like on this very basic experiential human level, like we see that there's something more appealing about these kinds of neighborhoods, and yet there are structures in place, there are people in power who push against this. You know, I mean, I think the expansion of suburbs, it's in the interest of a lot of people. We're looking to make a buck, we're looking to maintain their power. So I don't know. I mean, what do you see to be the future of these kinds of neighborhoods? Like, do you think they are going to be extinct? Do you think there's going to be a movement to try to revive them as the years come on?
The stiffness of those neighborhoods will be part of their doom. The R1 zoning, the impossibility of changing the footprint on the lot that's enforced by homeowners associations and local zoning customs. If you want to build an in-law apartment, if you want to convert to a two-family or a three-family inside a home, it's the very stiffness of these places, their inability to change with the times, that will be their undoing. We had a whole generation of well-paid boomers, well-paid and numerous boomers, who forced a certain kind of development in the United States. 3,500 square foot homes on enormous lots. And that place is now appealing to a much smaller portion of American home buyers who can neither afford that house right now, given current economic trends, can not only not afford that house, but don't want it. They're not having three kids and four kids. They're not even having two kids. They don't want long commutes to their jobs. They don't want half an acre of grass to mow or be mown by somebody else. So those places, which were very popular for a time, are going to prove that they were not really the kinds of places that grow old and grow loved over time. You walk through Old Town Alexandria, and you see an urban form that was built during the federal period and the colonial period, late 18th century, early 19th century. And here it is, 200 years later, still serviceable and excellent and beautiful and a place where people want to be. Those development perimeter jumbo house places are not going to operate in that same way, whether they are the more affordable ones in the middle of the country, or places like Basking Ridge, where houses routinely in New Jersey, where houses routinely sell for seven figures.
Yeah. So I want to, as we close things out, I want to focus in on New York, since, you know, that's your background. You've written plenty about it. What do you see happening there? Like, what shifts do you see happening in the various neighborhoods, especially in the boroughs of New York?
Historically, if you bet against New York, you lose. So I'm always reassured by the fact that they work it out. There are mountains and troughs. There are good eras and bad eras. And eventually it gets worked out in economic terms. The city repurposes itself, even facing the raft of subsidies that keep suburbs afloat surrounding it. New York remains competitive. There's a certain kind of American who wants to live that kind of life, which keeps demand high. Yeah, the city had a rough patch. I mean, the pandemic and its aftermath were terrible. But already, crime is starting to drop again, and even though in public perception, it's a lagging indicator. So it will only really be believed and really be true in people's heads maybe a year or two from now that right now crime again is dropping like a rock. The things that are wondrous about New York City, along with the things that are very difficult about it, let me be very honest, will continue to attract not only people who are trying to take their chances on America, and it's always been a beacon to those people. Go to Queens, one of the most dazzlingly diverse counties in the United States, but also the other places, the more rarefied precincts of Morningside Heights and Brooklyn Heights and Park Slope. Those places will also continue to prevail and continue to concentrate value and desire for a certain slice of Americans. Yeah, a lot of people tell me, look, I went to New York, I didn't like it, or I liked it, but I knew I couldn't live there because it's too much. Okay, fine. That's why we have such a diverse marketplace of life choices and lifestyles in the United States. Nobody's telling you you have to live in New York. But if you want to, you can. I hope some of the really terrible housing affordability problems of New York get worked out. The median income for a family in New York City is much lower than the national average. So start building a housing stock that responds to that instead of forcing people to spend such large portions of their take-home pay on a place to live. Start building more housing that responds to the actual needs of the marketplace. And I think New York will continue to thrive.
Yeah. What do you love most about New York, personally?
Boy, I wish that I could codify it and explain it as well as I explain other things. When I get off the train at Penn Station, and when I take the escalator up to the street level, my senses are alive. I smile. I must look like an idiot. And I start to walk toward Midtown, and I am a happy guy. I like being there. I like the action on the street. I like the crowdedness. I like the concentration. I like the diversity. I like listening to people talk on the streets and in the subways. I like how I can get around on two wheels, on 2 feet, not so much on four wheels, but that's fine. Maybe congestion pricing will help straighten that out as it did in London. I feel like I know who I am when I'm there.
Yeah, very well said. Very well said. So Ray Suarez, We Are Home is out now. People can order it, as well as The Old Neighborhood, your other books. Anything else you want to plug before we wrap up?
Let's be a little bit more understanding of new Americans. Let's be a little bit more understanding of people who are in danger and try to come here. Let's do an American return to values.
Amen. Thank you, Ray. Thanks so much.
Good to talk to you, Stephen. Thanks.
All right.